This has been a crazy news year. Tropical storms, wildfires, protests, rallies, investigations and resignations from Washington to Hollywood. But most of the stories that have really shaken things up had a national or international focus. So before we say goodbye to 2017, KCUR's Central Standard is gathering editors from community newspapers to talk about the important stories that happened here. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll start that conversation with the editor of a paper that's expanded its local coverage this year, the Shawnee Mission Post. Jay Center, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's talk first about changes to your paper this year, because it's not just that you've expanded, you've implemented a whole new model, how you're funded, the kind of content you've run, and it was a risky move.
Yeah, absolutely. So in April of this year, after nearly 7 years of operating the site, we've kind of reached a point where we determined that based on advertising revenue alone, we just were never going to be able to get to a point where we could sustainably staff the operation to have enough people out there covering all the beats that needed to be covered to produce a real news product for Northeast Johnson County.
That had to be a very scary moment.
I wasn't happy about it, Gina.
No.
It was a tough few months to make the decision. Yeah, because you have no idea. The norm on the internet over the course of the past 20 years has become that everything's free, and you just sort of expect that if you want to read some sort of news product, you're not going to have to pay anything for it. And unfortunately, that just doesn't work for a news operation of our size, where the amount of money you can generate from selling online ads is really pennies on the dollar compared to what you would have for a print product 20 or 30 years ago.
Or like a national website that...
Millions and millions of page views. So in April, we told our readers, listen, we love producing a news product for Northeast Johnson County. We think that the Shawnee Mission area deserves its own community news product. But if we're going to be able to continue doing it, we need the financial support of our readers. And so we put up a paywall in April and had no idea what to expect. And I got to say, probably one of the most heartening things in my life was that the response of readers was overwhelmingly positive. The numbers kind of worked out so that if we had gotten to 1,000 subscribers by April 2018, we would have been able to keep doing it. Well, we hit that number in 3 months.
Wow.
And so we're looking at, we're just under 1,500 subscribers now. So,
but you know what? Okay, so what you've done is, the paywall is part of it. You've also shifted the editorial focus, and the approach that you've taken is considered significant beyond the local area. It was written up by a Harvard lab that studies business models. And the pull quote from you at the top of that article reads as follows: "Nobody goes into journalism because they want to cater to advertisers and deliver them as many eyeballs as possible."
I stand by that statement. I think that's true. You know, when you are an ad-only supported news product, your incentive is toward your advertisers, right? And so whether consciously or not, you sort of shift toward a editorial mix that delivers the most eyeballs in probably a not particularly controversial way. You might, and I really do think this is sort of unconscious, but you sort of steer away from the really meaty community controversial issues that you would cover if you had a financial obligation to your readers, right, to the community that you're serving, to make sure that their public institutions are being held accountable. And so one of the things that we noticed was once the paywall went live, we were still doing that accountability kind of coverage before, but it was a smaller part of the mix. We realized that when we ran accountability stories, we would see 5, 6, 7 new subscriptions come in. And when we ran stories about a animal that somebody saw in somebody's backyard, we got a lot of page views, but no subscriptions out of that.
And yeah, so, no one was like, I am going to pay to stay on top of this animal in a backyard
situation. I mean, hey, it's interesting to watch the deer running through your backyard, but it's not worth $6 a month to me or whatever. So
this has actually changed your sense of what community news is and what community news is valuable to the community itself.
Absolutely. And I think like I said in that piece, like, nobody gets into journalism just because they want to, like, most people get into journalism do it because they think that there is a role for somebody out there to be shining light on our public institutions, our elected officials, where tax dollars are spent, things like that.
So what about you? I mean, why did you not only get into journalism, but with such a micro focus? It started out as Prairie Village.
Correct. So we started in June of 2010 as the Prairie Village Post, and we were covering Prairie Village, Mission Hills, and Fairway. When I moved back to Kansas in 2009, after having been in other parts for about a decade at that point, I grew up in Prairie Village and attended schools in Shawnee Mission. But when my wife and I moved back here in 2009, after we found out she was pregnant with our first child, I kind of opened up the paper like I was used to, looking for the neighborhood news tab that had all of the information about Prairie Village City Council and Shawnee Mission School District. And, you know, unfortunately, the kind of resource stresses that are facing all newspapers had hit the Kansas City Star, and that coverage that I had come to expect from the newspaper wasn't there anymore. And so, you know, it was pretty clear there was an opportunity here. You know, when we started the site, the city manager in Prairie Village told me that they hadn't had a reporter come to a meeting in like 8 months. And you just think about what that means, right? Nobody is there keeping an eye on what this governing body is doing with the resources, what decisions it's making about development plans that are getting approved. And we recognized really early on after we started that, yeah, there was a hunger. People still really do care about what's happening in their own little towns.
So what is the big story for you this year? It seems like the Shawnee Mission School District is at the heart of the big story.
Yeah, far and away. It has been tumultuous is not an overstatement. It has been a very challenging year for the Shawnee Mission School District on a lot of fronts. And I think what you've seen is that a lot of things that had sort of been bubbling under the surface for the past 2 or 3 years sort of came out into the open at the start of this year. And as a result of that, you saw a very active election season that resulted in the biggest turnover on the board in at least a quarter of a century. These three new board members who will be seated in January are going to be tasked with choosing the next superintendent for the district basically a week and a half after that they are seated. And I think you have seen teachers in the district kind of start to step forward and say, listen, you know, we haven't felt super respected over the course of the past 2 or 3 years, and we're looking to get into a position where we feel like we're a valued part of the Shawnee Mission community again.
So as the editor of the Shawnee Mission Post, I am guessing that you talk to just a ton of people, readers, not just the people you're interviewing. And I'm curious, what do people in your community say about why this story matters, how it's likely to impact their lives?
Well, Johnson County is a place where public education is pretty close to a religion, right? I mean, this is why people move to Johnson County, Kansas, is because between Shawnee Mission, Blue Valley, and Olathe, and the DeSoto school districts, you have some of the what have traditionally been some of the best rated public schools in the country. Great outcomes, great test results, great sense of community. People feel like, you know, I can buy a house in Johnson County for a relatively affordable price and send my kids to a school district where the quality of education they're getting would be similar to private schools in a lot of places. But what you have seen in Johnson County over the course, it's the Shawnee Mission area in particular, over the course of the past 15 or 20 years, is there's been a huge demographic shift. The Shawnee Mission School District, which basically covers the area inside the 435 loop on the Johnson County side, used to be in 2000 almost entirely white, almost entirely upper middle class or middle class. And there, it was just a very, very homogenous area. Since then, we have seen growing poverty, growing racial diversity, major changes in the amount of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch programs. And so Shawnee Mission has seen a student population that it wasn't used to serving before. As that has happened, the needs of the district have changed a lot. No longer sort of the special education programs and special services for kids with financial strains, those programs have become more and more and more important. And I think there's concern among a number of parents and patrons in the district that they weren't being administered as well as they could have been. So that's one factor that was going into it. The other thing that I think is interesting to note is that school boards traditionally operate, and this is across the board, school boards tend to operate in a much more covered up manner than a city council. For example, it is just much more accepted for school boards to do a lot of their business behind closed doors and during their public meetings have 7-0 votes. Well, in Shawnee Mission, the district was starting to make some decisions that a lot of parents were questioning, and the Board of Education was still sort of operating in this closed down manner where there wasn't a lot of explanation about how did we reach this decision, what were the other options that we considered, things like that. And so over the course of the past year, I think you've seen patrons step up and say, listen, we think that we need to reallocate some of our attention to make sure that we're serving these populations that we haven't maybe been serving as well as we need to. And we also need to be having a very open conversation about these things. And the way the board's operating right now is not fostering that.
It's interesting to me that the Kansas budget isn't something that comes up when you talk about this issue.
It is a huge factor, and it is sort of in the background of everything. And I think what one of the sort of final straws in the superintendent Jim Henson's decision to resign from the district was he sort of stepped out on his own during the budget discussions around, hey, what should a new school finance formula in Kansas look like at the start of the year? He sort of floated his own funding formula idea that basically got shot down by all of the public education community throughout the state. He had also alienated a lot of the local legislators in the Shawnee Mission area, like Melissa Rooker, who were advocating for basically a return to something much closer to the 1992 school funding formula. But basically, it's impossible not to look at what's happened in Shawnee Mission over the course of the past 5 or 10 years and come to the conclusion that the Kansas school funding formula has played a huge, huge role in that. Because as you saw dollars shrink over the course of the, you know, in the late 2000s, you saw class sizes rising, people noticing that their kids' classrooms weren't getting cleaned as frequently, things like that. And then Dr. Henson signed on to the block grant bill in 2015, I believe, which locked in funding regardless of how many kids were going to be served.
So the Shawnee Mission School District has been the big story for you this year. But there's also this more recent story that I want to just touch on quickly, because this is more the kind of story that you're less likely to see in a bigger news outlet, the ousting of a county commissioner.
I think it took everybody completely off guard who paid any attention to Johnson County government. Hannah Zacharias had been with the county for more than a decade, and you know, was basically one of the most well-respected public administrators in the metro area and really in the state. Had won all sorts of awards for his leadership. There are three ideologically fairly conservative members of the Board of County Commissioners, and they teamed up with a guy named Steve Klika, who's a moderate to conservative fellow, and voted to oust Hannah Zacharias at the end of last month. Nobody saw it coming, frankly.
And this is the kind of content that people are willing to pay money to read online, which gives me just immense amounts of hope, honestly, about local engagement in local politics.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I think what we have seen over the course of the past, 8 or 9 months since the paywall has gone live, is that there is a demand for, you know, quality, reliable coverage of what's happening in your community, and people are willing to pay for it.
Jay Center of the Shawnee Mission Post, which used to be the Prairie Village Post, thank you and congratulations on a big year.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Up next, we'll hear from the editors of the Kansas City Call, the Kansas City Hispanic News, and the Jewish Chronicle. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're taking stock of 2017 with editors from community newspapers here in town. And if there was a big story in your small community that was a big deal to you and the people you know, even though it didn't hit the media's radar, call and tell us about it at 816-235-2888. I'm here now with Eric Wesson of the Kansas City Call, Joe Arce of the Kansas City Hispanic News, and Barbara Bayer of the Kansas City Jewish Chronicle. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with just a quick lightning round to get us warmed up. What are the first few words that come to mind when you look back on 2017 in your communities? Eric?
Chaos.
Chaos. Joe?
DACA.
Barbara?
Politics.
Chaos, DACA, politics. Okay. I am guessing these things are going to come back up. We spoke earlier in the show with an editor who serves a geographic community, people who live in Shawnee Mission, which is a pretty cut and dry thing. There are boundaries of Shawnee Mission, and it's clear who exactly is reading this. You all serve communities of identity, communities of race, religion, language, which seems like a slightly more charged and in some ways also more complicated arena, considering where we are right now as a country.
I would agree with that. Our listeners, our readers, rather, pretty broad. We go from Kansas City, Kansas, to Lee Summit, to Blue Springs, to Olathe, to the heart of the urban core. So we have a very diverse group, and we have to bring a Black perspective to that diverse group of readers.
What does that mean exactly to you? I mean, what do you think it is that unifies, that determines a story that matters to the readers of the Kansas City Call?
I look at it as things that I want to know about. And then I try to investigate it, research it, and then put it into perspective so that people can. Because, you know, being a weekly, by the time our news gets out, it's already been out. So we have to put that perspective on it to get people a different angle, a different side of it. So,
Barbara, what is your sense of what the readers of the Jewish Chronicle are looking for?
The readers of our newspaper are looking for almost more local information than national information. We have the same problem that the Call has. We're a weekly, and so often things happen. When I go to press today, I'm worried that something on the front page is going to be totally wrong when it hits the mailboxes on Thursday.
Because everything changed,
and it's so easy to get information now. You know, you get it on your phone in 5 minutes. It'll flash on your phone. So we concentrate on stories that you're not going to be able to find on NBC News or anywhere else. So we do a lot of local features on things that people do, but we still have to cover the issues as well if they affect our readers in some way.
Joe?
Well, I'm in agreement with both of the publications. We do the same as well. The biggest issues that we have is getting mainstream to cover our community. There's so often, I'm sure we all run into this, where we don't see our local television station covering the same stories that we're covering. And also, because of the fact that we all are weekly, sometimes I look for something that is maybe a different angle to a story, although I know it's going to be dated. But I go into it and I tell my reporters at the same time, give me something that I don't know. Give our readers something that they don't know. And we can start at least with the story, with that information. We have to have the present information, but you don't have to lead with that. You know, you kind of bury that information towards the bottom. But give us something fresh. Give us a different perspective of a story. So we just don't want to give the obvious out there, because I think the television stations and those that are on a daily basis or hourly basis, they can give you the obvious. So we have to look for something that's not so obvious so that we can build the story from that point.
It's interesting to me that your biggest frustration is not seeing the news, that the kind of news you're covering in the bigger media outlets. So many media outlets don't want to be scooped, don't want the competition, but as far as just having your voices and your stories out there, it sounds like that would actually be great in your mind.
You would think so. But the problem that I find is that, and I like having exclusives. Don't get me wrong. I'll be the first one to tell you, you know, let me have that exclusive. And then, and this happened where maybe a television station would call me and get my reaction to an exclusive story that we're working on. But the thing of it is that it has to be documented. And so often I can document it in print, but it should be nice from time to time that the television stations, and this has been one of my pet peeves because I have a television background as well, that the Latino community is underserved when it comes to media coverage, when it comes to broadcasts, whether it be radio or whether it be print. And so it's a challenge for them, I know, but they are underserved. The thing of it is that the media, broadcasting and television, they need to take the Latino community seriously because they are a viewer and they are a rating point. And so they need to think about that in those terms and cover news that is going on in the community.
Eric is nodding.
Yeah. And one of the things that's really frustrating to me about it, when you have mainstream covering things in the urban core, they always go to the same three black people for a response. It's like, you know, there are 50,000 black people in Kansas City, and they always go to the same three people. And they're, when I see their names, I already know what the quote is going to be. I already know what the comment is going to be. And I would like to see if they're going to do something. Go out, meet some new black people. Get some new comments. We have a lot of super intelligent, articulate black people in the community. Go out and talk to them. It's not always about homicides. Usually when you see information on the news in the urban core, it's about crime. And I think that that is such a disgrace to the community to always talk about crime. We've got a lot of great things going on in the urban core, but you never hear about them.
Okay, so we're going to hear some of the stories that the editors we've got convened around this table right now look back on when they think about 2017. And I'm going to start, Joe, with you, because you were saying, yeah, your biggest frustration is not seeing some of those stories covered or covered in the way you would want to see in the local media more broadly.
Well, for instance, we've had we have a large Hispanic population, and there's been several rallies here in Kansas City in regards to immigration and to DACA. And some folks may be wondering, well, what is DACA? And that basically is a student that's here illegally in this country, but that was brought over by their parents, possibly, or a person that is related to them into this country, and the students want to go to school. They're fearful. They don't know what's going to happen to them or their families. Now, I will admit that I've seen from time to time a little bit of coverage, but there have been so many different rallies and meetings, and the topic it doesn't go away for us in the Latino community. And but from time
so
to time,
it's not just we did that story. It's,
yeah,
this story is daily life.
It's a daily life. I mean, we see the students, we see the fear. I mean, as a publisher, I was asked to go to one particular school here in Kansas City to talk to the students and ask. They wanted to know how we were covering the story. And I had to reassure them, you continue to study. There are people that have your back. There are people out there, civic leaders that are working on this issue. But you as a student need to continue in your studies. And so, but not only were they worried about themselves, but they were also worried about their parents. What's going to happen to them? The breakup of the home. So it's a hot topic in our Latino community. And you don't have to be here illegally for it to have an impact, because it affects all Latinos in the greater Kansas City area around the country as well.
What are some of the ways that you would tell that story about how it does affect all Latinos in the Kansas City area? Something that you, yeah, haven't heard more broadly in the news.
Well, we hear the stories from the students. We hear the stories from the families. The thing of it is that sometimes we hear the same story. It just, the name has changed. It goes from a Lopez to a Gonzalez to a Martinez or Rodriguez, but it's all the same. And so, some of these families, they're not aware that there are agencies and community groups that are getting together and trying to help resolve these fears the questions that they may have in regards to it. There's so many different aspects to this particular topic of immigration and DACA. So often there's some fraud involved in this as well, where you can find an attorney that maybe is giving them some sort of information. They're telling them that, you know, that the immigration laws are changing on a regular basis. And so, you know, we look into that as well.
Would the upshot of that be, so you need to keep coming back and paying fees to me, the attorney?
Possibly, yeah, yeah.
And so it sounds like part of what you are doing in your coverage is letting the Latino community know not just the sort of high stakes questions that people are asking, but also what's being done to help people who might be in precarious situations.
Absolutely.
Or what might be done to hurt people who are in precarious situations.
Right, right. And also do want to point out, we have a tremendous group of immigration attorneys as well that are doing a wonderful job, and they do give back in terms of community service by helping them fill out the applications and so on and so forth. But you're always going to have a little bit of a group that might take advantage of a situation. So again, it's something that we do keep a close eye on as well.
Tell me about a rally or protest that you covered where something that you felt was really important happened, or where you witnessed something moving or significant that you wish a broader readership or listenership or viewership had access to.
Well, I can tell you this. A couple of years back, I attended a rally down at the plaza because I cover immigration, the different angles. Chris Kaulbach was holding a rally down on the plaza with a couple of other politicians, and I was doing my interviews. I was trying to cover it because I wanted to get their perspective. I wanted for our readers to know what the Chris Kaulbachs of the world are thinking and what they're saying about DACA and other immigration issues. By the time I got through with that interview, talking to different folks there, as I was doing my job, I was called a wetback. They said to me, "Wetback, go back home."
Whoa!
And to be honest with you, I had already been in this business for 45 years. I have never been called that name, and it shocked me. And I got in my car and I thought about it for just a few minutes. And I'll be honest with you, it brought a tear to my eye. I was born here in Kansas City, Missouri, but yet the color of my skin, I guess, reflects the sentiments of those folks that are against immigration, that are against DACA. And trust me, when the people say, go back home, in Mexico they don't want us because we're born here in the United States. And then United States people are telling that to us. You know, it's a different time.
And that happened to you as a reporter? I mean,
as a reporter. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, so Joe Arce would like to see immigration and particularly the questions surrounding DACA covered in a different way locally, and that's been one of his big stories at the Kansas City Hispanic News this year. Eric Wesson, what's been one of your big stories at the Kansas City Call?
Of course, homicides, because there's so many of them. A lot of them are domestic. I guess another big story would have been the county jail. That's another issue.
What about the county jail?
Just the violence that's going on there. People attacking guards, people in there getting raped. I think one of the things is that people are accused of a crime when they're picked up and they're arrested and they're put in the county jail. Going to the county jail, you shouldn't be serving your sentence. And a lot of that is what it is, because you've had several rapes there. You've had several people. And these are the things that are reported. The non-reported things are the grandmothers that call and say that their grandsons or the aunts call saying their nephews were attacked in the county jail, beat up.
They call you?
Yeah, they call us. Being in the Call is like an advocacy newspaper. People call us about their water bills. They call us about trash not being picked up. because it's not just reporting the news that we do. We're the voice of those people that are voiceless. So they'll call. I have people call me about anything and everything. And some of it has absolutely nothing to do with news. Last week, a lady called me. She had a flat tire. She was running late for a job interview. She hadn't had a job in years. This was her final interview. She wanted a job, but she wanted a way to get to the, to work, to the interview. And I was like, so call her Uber or a cab. So we helped her out in making sure that she got to work, got to the interview.
Well, Eric, you were saying a minute ago that you would like all the stories not to be so focused on homicide, on violence. And I totally appreciate that. Of course, that doesn't make that not a big story. But what is another story you would tell us? I know that issues surrounding Parade Park are interesting to you right now.
Parade Park, Governor Greitens doing away with low-income tax credits, not funding that. And that is the incentive that gets developers into the urban core to build housing. And one of the shortages that we have in the urban core is affordable housing for seniors. So now without having that funding there, that means that developers, when they buy the tax credits, developers buy tax credits like they're a dollar, but it costs them 86 cents to buy, so they have 14 cent profit. So that's the incentive to get them to come into the urban core, the Hispanic community, and build housing. So doing away with that, and actually Parade Park had a group of developers at the table wanting to put together a deal. He cut that funding. That's going to mean that most of them are going to walk away from that deal because there's no incentive. And getting people into the urban core, prospect development, there's a lot of plans and there's things on the table for development in that area. But whether or not they'll make it from the drawing board to actual being implemented is going to be two different things now.
So Parade Park itself, though, what is that? That's a housing.
It's a housing. It is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, African-American co-op in the country. It was the people there buy into it. They're supposed to originally own the units that they're living in and they're buying. Somewhere along the line, that equity has changed. The people don't have equity in there, even though they've been there for 20 or 30 years. So Parade Park is a great low crime area for a lot of time, and you had a lot of seniors, had a lot of low income people live there, and it was a nice place to live. It was clean, manicured, a little bit of grass that they have there. Well, now all that's in jeopardy, and one of the things about that is the developer that came in wanted to buy it. Then they were afraid he was going to do remodeling and throw the people out or raise their rent so that they couldn't afford to live there anymore.
Man, so
gentrification is what it is. But when you look at 18th Street now, or you look in that area now, you have the baseball academy they just spend millions of dollars with. Right next to it is Parade Park. So something is going to have to be done to develop, to connect those two, because you can't have that nice ball academy there and then run down housing right next to it.
So this is something that you'll continue looking into. I'm guessing it's going to be a big story in 2018, too.
Absolutely. Those places need to be renovated. They need to be remodeled because you got a lot of seniors and everything is upstairs and a lot of them can't walk up the steps. So, yeah, we're going to stay on top of that story.
All right. So thank you, Eric Wesson. We'll be getting back to both of the editors we've just heard from. But Barbara Bayer, what's been a big story for you at the Jewish Chronicle?
You know, it's been kind of a quiet year this year, but I've noticed that the fact that the world is so uncivil, and again, going back to politics, anti-immigration has been a huge issue in the Jewish community. It's Jews in the community were immigrants at one time, so they're very supportive of immigrants, and anti-Muslim and anti-anything really hits a sore spot because of the Holocaust, and in history it's been anti-Semitism, anti-Jews. So the Jewish community has come out in full force to volunteer for things like the Muslim community and the refugee community, done a lot of protest, things like that.
It is kind of surprising to me to hear you talk about anti-Semitism in history with all these other antis in the present tense, especially in a year where there has been national and international focus on a neo-Nazi resurgence or a white supremacist resurgence. And I'm a little surprised to not hear that as one of your big stories.
Well, you know, I wonder if it's because we're kind of used to it. And, you know, it seems to be happening more and more. So it's like, it's almost like when you hear about a shooting in a school, you go, oh, another school got shot at. I had forgotten some of the anti-Semitic things that had happened through the year.
You're saying you've been desensitized?
I think so. You know, beginning of the year, there was a lot of bomb threats at Jewish community centers and Jewish institutions across the country. We did not escape that. That happened here at a couple of our synagogues and at the Jewish community center. Apparently, there was more this summer that weren't even reported. We found out about it when the FBI arrested a suspect from doing several bomb threats here in town and also one in Washington, D.C. that I think the guy got congregation names confused, actually, because there's a congregation with almost the same name here in town, so maybe just got the wrong phone number. Yeah, I think we're a little desensitized about that, and I think right now many of the Jewish community are just very much into politics.
Well, I want to get back to politics, but what is your editorial philosophy when it comes to covering the kinds of incidents, bomb threats at synagogues that you just talked about?
Well, that's interesting. We just did, when the FBI arrested that suspect a couple weeks ago, and we found out about the most recent bomb threats that we didn't even know about, we have a small staff, but we had a really interesting discussion on how do we cover it? Do we cover it, you know, what is the break between what you need to know versus how to keep the community safe? We have someone called a Jewish security director that was hired after the shootings in April 2014. They won't talk on the record. You know, they don't want to tell us things. They bring the police in, and every bomb threat has been not credible. So sometimes that they have felt the need to evacuate the buildings, and then people in the buildings know. Oftentimes, I don't know how police work works, but they have ways quickly to find out whether it's necessary or not. Sometimes you never even know what happens. So, and we're in those buildings all the time, and we don't want, you know, it's a matter of what do we tell people, what do we not tell people so that the community stays safe, so there's not copycats. It's a really fine line, and we're having trouble with that.
Like, there's sometimes a reason, in your view, to not share that information?
Well, often we can't share it because we can't get anybody to tell us on the record, you know. I can't be everywhere all at once, so I wasn't in these buildings when they may have been evacuated.
Wow. Well, that's Barbara Bayer with the Kansas City Jewish Chronicle. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've got to take one last break this morning, then we'll get back to our year in review with the editors of local community papers on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with the editors of three community newspapers, the Kansas City Call, Kansas City Hispanic News, and the Kansas City Jewish Chronicle. Pardon me there. They are talking about the big stories of 2017 in their communities. And we were just hearing from Barbara Bayer about what wasn't in her paper sometimes, the Jewish Chronicle. Barbara, you said when I asked everyone what is the word that comes to mind when you think of 2017, you said politics.
Absolutely. There's just so much. It seems like people aren't nice to each other anymore, and that can all be taken back to last year's political campaign. And maybe it started before that, but it became really evident then. I'd say 60, 70, maybe 80% of the Jewish community are not fans of our president. And things that have happened throughout the country that have started things here in town, such as the riots in Charlottesville, which brought about some interfaith, how can we fix this, conversations in Kansas City after that happened. The March on Washington, which then there was a March on Kansas City, which several Jewish women helped organize, helping the refugees. Every single thing that people seem to talk about right now seems somehow to be connected with politics. Healthcare, taking away our healthcare, taking away what they're talking about with DACA and even tax credits, you know, that's where it's at right now.
So even in the community newspapers, the national politics are kind of looming large, it sounds like. Is that your experience as well, Joe and Eric?
Yes. It has a huge impact. You know, if you look back at our president when he was running, when he announced his campaign, he kind of engaged everyone with hatred and talking about the Mexican people there with the rapists and thugs and murderers, and that Mexico, they don't send their best people, they send their worst people. Well, that's a reflection on our ancestors. People in our community were saying, "What my grandfather, when he came into this country, he wasn't a thug, he wasn't a murderer, he wasn't a rapist." So people can relate to these comments. So, you know, this racial issue was actually, and people say, we're divided country now. Well, you know, we can attribute a lot of that to our president.
Eric?
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that we've known, but it wasn't so blatant. As black people, we know about the racism, we know about the discrimination, but now people have a license and the green light to go ahead and say it. Before, it was like something that they might whisper in the back room. Now they will openly say it out in public, you know, and even not just so much as what Joe was talking about. Now, even with the sexual assaults and those things, when you have the commander in chief or the president, if you like to call him that, saying that he grabs women, it's okay. So now all these other guys are, well, like, the president grabs women, so why can't I? So he's changed the climate in this country dramatically, and it's something that we report on when we have to.
And not for the better.
No, not for the better.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of strong feelings about national politics in this room, and that's, mm-hmm. of course, to be expected. National politics affect us all. But let's get back to that sort of granular community level. Joe, there's a really sad story out of your community that you wanted to share, thinking about the big stories of 2017.
We have seen a dramatic increase in suicides, and we also see a lack of services for families. You know, it's a topic that sometimes goes silent. We have seen people ask after a suicide has taken place, people ask, well, how did this happen and why did it happen? And with the budget cuts that we're seeing, there's lack of mental health facilities for families. And so it's been a difficult time in our Latino community, but people also ask, why is this happening? And it has to do with economics. It has to do with lack of medical care. One of the things that we did in our community this year through an agency, Manny Rhodes, we created a venue for families, and we brought them together for a day of remembrance. And this particular year, we not only honored those that have died in some sort of violent way, but we also created it to help families deal with suicide. Because so often there's a stigma that people just stop talking about that loved one that has passed away. But those family members needed some sort of gathering to come together and to support one another. And on Memorial Weekend, Manny Rhodes created this event to honor all folks that have died in a violent way, and also to honor those families and also those that chose that route, to honor them as well, because we don't know exactly why this is happening, but at the same time, you can't forget them.
That is such a hard thing to cover in a public forum, because it's such a shared problem, but any specific incident is also such a private trauma. Mm-hmm. And that requires so much sensitivity.
It does. And at the same time, when we talked to those families that attended this event, they were so thankful because there were so many other people that understood what they were going through. So I guess in one sense, it was a sense of therapy for them.
To air their stories,
yes,
out in the public.
Yes.
You said that we don't know why, but it's the increase in suicide in the Latino community, is that local or national?
This is locally here. This is what we're noticing. And the reason that we noticed that, and we did a three-part series on this, we started with one individual that attempted suicide, and we kind of wanted to get a perspective of when people start thinking about suicide. And then we went to talk to some families that their loved ones had committed suicide. So we dedicated our newspaper to a three-part series on this particular topic. But we found was that it was therapeutic to the readers because we got calls. And then it went on Facebook. And we were getting 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 hits per week just on that story alone. It's a silent, silent topic that families have to deal with. And, you know, for so many years, I think it's time now that it come out and we start talking about and dealing with it.
Wow. Well, Joe Arce, thank you for telling us about that. Eric Wesson, is there a silent topic within your community that you feel you've gotten to help, I don't know, bring attention to this year?
I would think probably the most silent topic is going to probably be, and it's gotten some press, but not as much as it should, is probably the people that live over off of 31st and Cleveland that have the gasoline in their homes that is leaking out somewhere. The petroleum, the odor is leaking out there in their houses, showers, kitchen sinks. A lot of people in that two-block radius off of 31st and Mercington and Cleveland and Askew pretty much have to do bottled water with everything. And some people on certain times of the year say they even shower and bathe with bottled water because of the petroleum that's leaking into the water system. So that would probably be the silent story. It's kind of flying under the radar, but it's a very serious problem. And the homicides, we don't like, and Joe brings up a lot of interesting points. We don't like to admit that we have mental health issues, and how we deal with mental health issues in our society now with the budget cuts for mental health. We put people in prison. And we just put them there and hope that they'll either get better or worse, but they're out of society now. And we have a very serious mental health issue in the Black community when you have a lot of people. You got, 147, 148 homicides, and it's just people not being able to resolve conflict. So mental health is something that we don't talk about as much as we should either.
So last time we had this conversation, the four of us here, I was really struck by a feeling that we weren't, as a city, all living in some ways in the same city. You know what I mean? Like
that. It took you that long to figure that.
I understand that, but it really hit home during that conversation. Just when you say the big stories and people are sharing things that are just so outside of one another's realities in some way. There is one side of that that's sad and a problem. The idea of that we don't share in each other's, in solving each other's problems if we can't share in knowing about each other's problems. But also, is there a side of this that's like, that's also part of what makes it an interesting tapestry of a city? Or is that just me hoping for a silver lining?
That's probably you hoping for a silver lining. People along the corridor, let's say state line area, you got people there on the plaza area. They have absolutely no connection to the, and they don't realize that the problems east of Truce affect the issues west of Truce as well. It's just not as blatantly in front of their faces. But yeah, you're looking for that silver lining.
You know, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. We have broadcast stations here. We have radio stations here. We have a mainstream because we're considered alternative papers. They're underserving our community, whether it be the Black community, the Jewish community, or the Latino community. You would know more about these stories possibly because they have a larger readership. They have a larger viewership as well and listenership. But you know, feel free to contact any of us because we can share this information. We're more than happy so that we can get these stories out, you know, in a broader perspective.
Barbara?
I think that in our instance, we do live in sometimes more than one community. I learned a lot today. and I would say that some of these things have spurred members of the Jewish community to get out and be more active and actually do hands-on volunteering because they live in a different community than some of the other people in our city.
Well, our time is up, but Joe Arce with us from the Kansas City Hispanic News, Eric Wesson of the Kansas City Call, and Barbara Bayer of the Kansas City Jewish Chronicle, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing to look for that silver lining, I'm going to hope for good news in 2018. You think that'll happen? Come on.
Let's hope so.
Let's try.
Keep talking to us about the stories that matter to you and your community. We're at KCURCST on Twitter, and you can email us, centralstandard@kcur.org. Listen back to this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it for you by the end of the day. Yesterday's podcast review was a lot of fun, so check that out too, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we are all processing new ideas and expectations around sexual misconduct and gender relations. Central Standard's hosting a community forum to work through it, so tune in. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman.